This is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctor's Digest. And as always, it's great to get together with you. And we've got a couple great interviews that you're going to tremendously enjoy. They're very different, and that's okay because we've got a lot of topics we want to cover on our audio magazine. First of all, we're going to talk to Steve Manning, and Steve is doing a direct primary care practice model. He's a young doctor, just in practice for a short while, enthusiastic about how this has been so good for his family, so good for his patients, and for his ministry in medicine. So I think he's going to give you some insights into this option if you're considering it or influencing others on how they're going to move forward when they move into their practice years. And then we're going to talk to Dr. Tim Elmore, who's written a book called Marching Off the Map, really trying to help us understand future generations. He's an expert on Generation Y, Generation Z, and we're going to delve into what are the characteristics, how do you communicate? And I know many of you are working with students and have your own children and your own families, and this is going to give you some practical information to delve in and understand these generations and how to communicate with them and influence them in their lives. Well, I think you're going to be richer for listening to these interviews. I'm glad you could join us. Let me introduce you to Steve Manning, a young family medicine doctor. He earned his bachelor's degree in exercise physiology from Eastern Carolina University in Greenville, earned his MD at Brody School of Medicine at the same institution, and then did his residency there. He was a junior chief resident and finally chief resident of that residency program. He serves as the vice chief of staff at Martin General Hospital in his hometown where his practice is. He also is an affiliate professor in the Department of Family Medicine at ECU. He was a Williamston native. His goal was to go back home and open a practice of quality medical care. But following 3 years of watching patients become stressed, dealing with insurance companies, and noticing how much of his practice was devoted to processing paperwork, he took a radical step. He opened an independent, subscription-based practice called Access Medicine. And we're going to talk to him about that. Stephen, you've done something most docs haven't done. You've gone in direct primary care. Explain that for people that may not know that topic. What does that mean, and why did you take that step?
Direct primary care is sort of a larger umbrella term for membership medicine. A lot of the people may remember concierge medicine, which is still around. But a lot of us who want to offer primary care sort of for everyone have gone into direct primary care. And what it really comes down to is it's a direct relationship with your patient financially. And so patients typically pay a monthly, yearly, or quarterly membership to the practice. And based on that membership, they have access to the practice for chronic medical problems, acute medical problems that come up. So they're able to access the doctor. And a lot of practices like ours offer enhanced access. So they have access to us through email, texting, and phone conversations whenever they really need us. So it really is a focus on taking the insurance provider out of the equation and out of the exam room and getting back to simply doctor-patient. So when a patient comes to my office, I'm really employed by the patient. They're paying for my services and to see me. So that really allows us to focus on, okay, now I'm freed up a little bit. I'm not restricted by some of the insurance restrictions and guidelines that I've got to do when you're billing insurance. So that takes out of the equation and we can focus on the care, provide the best care I can to the patient.
What drove you to do this? I mean, did you start out this way or did you come from more the typical practice where, you know, there's people in the back doing all the insurance stuff and pre-authorizations and all sorts of things going on? How did you end up doing this?
Well, I did the traditional model, the insurance model practice for about 3 years. And I came out of residency and really didn't think there was another option, honestly, like a lot of residents. I went into a hospital-employed practice, you know, the typical sign on bonus, benefits, all the things you're looking for as a new doc. I jumped in, you know, head first into all that. And at first, it was a good situation. I actually was able to open a new office with the hospital, which is actually in my hometown. And so, you know, I came back and did that. And over that 3-year period, all the things you just mentioned, the prioritizations, the insurance minutiae, daily having to see 25 to 30 patients per day, all those things really began to impair my ability to practice good clinical medicine. But also, I wasn't able to have really good conversations with patients. I wanted to be able to provide more than just a medical answer. I wanted to be able to provide them with spiritual guidance, addressing some of those needs. And there was no time for it. There's just no time to deal with those things and the medical side of things. So during my second year of my contract, I decided there had to be a better way to provide good primary care for patients. And so I began to search that out. And, you know, actually, one night I'm sitting in my office. It's about 9 o'clock at night, and I'm charting. I'm doing what a lot of docs are doing right now. They're at their office and trying to catch up. And I just had a God moment. This guy that did this model came to my mind, and I wasn't thinking about him and at all. It was a totally unique moment. And I sought him out, and I asked, you know, how do you do this? What does it look like? And over that next year, I decided I'm going to do this model. This gives me the flexibility, the freedom, the time I want with patients. And I decided to do it and begin to plan that process. And so in 2014 is when I started my direct primary care practice, which is also in my hometown. So it's been a fun time. And
are you doing this as a solo practitioner? You have other people with you?
I'm the only physician in my office. I do have a physician assistant who works with me. And we're growing. We're actually expanding to a new office in Washington, which is a city not far from us, about 20 minutes away. Where a new doc is going to be there working with us.
What's not paid for? I mean, people need laboratory work, x-ray work. They pay for that with traditional insurance they have or out of pocket. Or how do you handle the extraordinary cost when, you know, you can't take care of them in your office yourself?
Well, each practice is unique. We sort of say in this model, when you've seen one DPC practice, you've seen one because, you know, each one is unique and they'll decide what they want to cover or what's actually included in the membership and what's not. For our practice, we basically include anything we do in the office that really doesn't cost us anything, we include as part of the membership. So when I do an EKG on a patient or spirometry or, you know, even skin tag removal, basic procedures, it's included. There's no charge for those things whatsoever. If I do something like a knee injection or those kind of things, it may cost us a little bit and the patient will pay for that, but typically a very minimal cost. You know, some practices will include lab work in their fees. We typically charge for that, but it's pennies on the dollar for what most insurance practices charge a self-pay patient for insurance for their labs. Now, if a patient has insurance, they can actually use that in our office for lab fees. So, again, it's sort of dependent upon each practice, and we just decide it works best for us and our patients, and some prefer to use their insurance for some things like that, because our lab company will bill their insurance for us. We don't do any of that in the office because it takes time, and that's the reason we got out of that rat race model. But it works for us and our patients. And, you know, for me, it kind of comes down to whatever it seems to work best for our patients and what they want. And a lot of patients will just pay our fees for labs and those kind of things. if we send patients for a specialist visit or for imaging, we have worked hard to get a network of practices that we can provide options for the patient. So their fees are lessened. We get, you know, good providers who will give us good deals for our patients, and we transfer that on, you know, back to the patient. So it works well for them, and they get to see the specialist, or, you know, get the X-ray or the CAT scan, MRI, whenever needed.
Yeah. And don't pay the full rack rates of not having insurance, which, as you know, can be 3 or 4 times as high if you just walk off the street, unfortunately, in our country, and get things like hospitalization. What's the difference between this and simple care? And I, as I define simple care, you know, I have a CMDA member who's my private doc, and he used to be at the practice, and the insurance was filed and all the rest of it, and all the people to do that. And now I go to his office, pay cash, pay with my HSA, and he hands me a insurance form, I mean insurance paper that I can file myself, but he's not going to do it. Is that basically the difference, or is there more than that?
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities between that description of what you're describing and direct primary care. Some practices doing direct primary care do exactly that.
Yeah.
You can come in and be seen for an annual physical. You'll get a detailed invoice that gives you, you know, if you have private insurance, then you can use that form to submit to your insurance provider for reimbursement. And we allow that for our patients as well if they want to do that. I've found that most don't do that because they end up, at least for the monthly membership fees, typically takes more time than they want to put into it, and what they get back is not usually worth it. That's usually different for an annual physical. If we actually put an annual physical code on it, they'll get back often, for our practice, about half of what a yearly membership costs. For those folks, they who do that, they actually benefit from it.
Can I ask what an annual membership costs?
Sure. So for our practice, it's $550 for an adult. So it's $50 a month for an adult. For pediatric patients, newborn to 19, it's $25 a month. So for if you pay a year, you get a month free. That's where the $550 comes in. And we do year for pediatric. We also do a membership plan for couples. It's $90 a month for couples, $990 a year. And then also for families is $100 a month, which is actually capped. So if you have two parents and five children, it doesn't go any higher than $100 a month.
Wow. That's a bargain.
But if you think about it, most of the time in primary care, and I love seeing kids, we have a good amount, probably 15-20% of our practice is pediatrics. And most of the time, pediatric patients don't really cost you much.
Yeah.
They don't really require a lot of extra finances as far as the practice goes. So we can offer a lower membership and help those patients out.
How does this affect your staffing?
That's the wonderful part about this. You know, in my previous practice, 60% of my overhead went to billing insurance. And so that required additional staff. And most practices have typically 4 to 5 full-time employees per physician. That's a national average. And so the wonderful thing about this model is that overhead decreases dramatically. And so I no longer have to have tons of staff. I can have actually one medical assistant or one, we call them patient care coordinator, because they do so much more than just medical assisting. One per physician or one per physician assistant or whoever it might be, and that's all you need. But that person for us is really sort of cross-trained to do everything in the office, answer phones, draw labs, assist me for procedures, really do everything that's needed in the office. And so we can keep that overhead low by limiting staff and limiting the extra things that you typically will see in the insurance practice.
So how big is your patient panel? Now, you know, you're not having to see 25, 30 patients a day. How many patients or memberships would you have? Maybe it should be patients because memberships can be families.
That's right. Well, right now, and I would base it on our medical system sort of counts patients, and right now we have in the range of 800 to 900 total, and that's between myself and my PA. So most practices doing this model have somewhere between 600 to 1,200 at the most. Unlike most typical insurance practices, we'll have somewhere in the range of 2,000 to 3,000 per doc. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the model exists by keeping the panel size low. So in order to provide the access, the time with patients, we offer same day or next day visits guaranteed. So to offer those things, I have to keep the panel lower, which is, in my mind, honestly, as a physician who wants to provide the best care I can, that's actually a really good thing, because now I know my patients really well. I'm not having to see 3,000 people and try to make sure that I'm on top of everything for those 3,000 folks. So when I really have 700-800, I can take really great care of those people and provide the best care I think possible.
So what's this done for your work life and your family life? Because obviously both of those are important, and with fewer patients but with greater access, what's it look like?
Well, that's one of the things that has been wonderful about this. Now, if you ask my wife, she will tell you I still work hard. And there are times when I'm still at the office late, and that's, I think I've just resolved that's a part of being a physician. You yeah. know, we work. But I'm running my office. I'm reevaluating things. I'm doing things I enjoy. I'm running a business. Mm-hmm. And so that's a fun part of it for me. And so she would tell you that I am a billion times happier, no question. Still work hard, but I love it. But I also am able to build in more time with my family in general. I'm home more often than I was when I was just trying to make it, seeing that many people a day and just trying to get through the day and get things done. I'm able to spend more time with the kids, really. And because I run my own office, I can actually carve out a half day if I need to. I can have my PA available and I can get out of the office if I need to. And that's something that a lot of docs don't have anymore. You know, I think, and if you look at the statistics on how many new residents are coming out going to employed practices, it's staggering. Almost no one is doing their own practice anymore. And this model actually, I think, revitalizes the ability to go out and hang your own shingle and have your own practice again. Yeah. And it's a really, really good thing.
Yeah, it's, private practice is a dying thing, unless you're way out in a remote area, and even then you're usually in a group to handle it. What's been the impact on your patients? And then we'll move to the ministry aspects of it. Let's just talk satisfaction and what kind of feedback you're getting.
Patients love it. They really do. They love it as much as I do. In fact, I've had several tell me, you know, don't you ever think about going back to the way things used to be. Yeah. This is so good. And what happens with that is they go out and tell their families. They go out and tell other patients. When they hear someone, I have patients come to me because they've become disenfranchised with the current system, and they're not being heard, they're not being listened to, their condition is not being evaluated properly. And so they end up coming to us because they just haven't been listened to well. And it's not because I'm such a great doctor. I desire to provide the best care I can. I think I'm pretty good. But often it's because I can sit down and I can take 30 minutes or an hour and listen. And when I listen to them, I can find out what's really going on and then address the specific issues. And when you do that with a patient, when you sit down with them for an hour as a physician, and you're not looking at a computer screen, you're looking them in the eye, and you have a chance to communicate and engage with them, they're changed by it. They go out and they tell other patients about it, and they say, you got to go see this practice. And that's been the best advertisement we could ever dream of. So, you know, we've actually had patients who have said, I'm not sure about this, but I'll try it. And once they try it, we hardly ever lose patients. And it usually, if we do, it's usually because they move somewhere. So they love it, and we do too. And I've told them, you know, I've told many patients that I would, if I was unable to do this model for some reason, I would seriously consider getting out of medicine. Or at least not doing primary care, because it's become so difficult. And the way that I can spend time with my patients and address the things I want to do now, it would be really, really difficult if I couldn't do that. So it's that good.
How many patients you normally see in a day, on an average day?
I typically see between 10 and 12.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about the spiritual ministry. You know, you talked about the importance of that to you, and I think everyone listening wants to do good integrated spiritual care into their practice. What's the impact been on that?
Tremendous. And that's really, that was one of the primary motivations I had for moving to this model. It's just really becoming a little frustrated that, you know, wanting a desire to engage patients spiritually and not having the time to do it was just a little, was frustrating. So when I thought about how to do this and how to do primary care, because I love primary care, the direct primary care model was perfect for that. So now I have typically 30 minutes minimum with each patient, and there's time at the end of the visit or during the visit to really engage them in spiritual matters and really to make my practice a ministry, and look at my job as a physician as part of my ministry and to bring the gospel to patients. You know, as I'm sure you know, patients often are dealing with not just the physical aspects of their disease and illness. They're dealing with the mental and the spiritual, and they need that guidance. And I often will pray with patients and utilize prayer as a means to bring the gospel to them if they're someone who I don't know knows the Lord and really needs to hear that hope. But we still have time to really, you know, say, I realize you're hurting, and here's the hope I have. Here's the relationship I have with God and through Christ, and really be able to spend time engaging in them and find out where they are. And that, you know, there's just no substitute for time. And having that time is what it comes down to.
Well, and, you know, there's nobody there telling you can't do this either. You're your own boss, which, you know, so much in corporate medicine, people are coming under scrutiny and more and more restrictions trying to be put on them, and this lets you run your practice like you want to run your practice and to do the ministry you want to do. Stephen, if they want to, people want to get more information on this, how would they do it? Can you give us any resources? Because I can hear people's minds clicking over saying, I got to take a look at this and think about this path for me as well. You know, you met somebody who gave you some advice and how to do this. Do you know of any place where people can get more information?
A great website that docs may want to take a look at, or even patients, is called dpcfrontier.com. And that's a great resource. It actually has a map of all the direct primary care practices across the country. And if you have any questions about that, it's kind of geared more for docs. If you have questions about the model or where practices are located, that's a great resource. The American Academy of Family Physicians has also hosted a direct primary care summit once a year, and that's has been in Indianapolis, Indiana. We just had that this past June, and a great resource, excellent talks, really kind of a nuts and bolts conference on how the model runs, what it looks like, how to do it yourself. And so that's a really good resource as well.
Well, thank you for being a pioneer and for stimulating our minds today. I really, really appreciate it, and God bless you as you continue to minister to those patients in ways that many doctors have more and more trouble doing.
Thank you, Dave.
Boy, I loved learning about direct primary care. Maybe you'll never be involved in it, but now at least you'll understand it better. Or maybe you're saying, yeah, I like to know more. I'm glad we've got some great resources that'll help you in that area. You know, as we talk about practice in general, I encourage you, if you don't have it already, to get Practice by the Book, A Christian Doctor's Guide to Living and Serving. It's a resource that CMDA produced that's very unique. It talks about how to combine your faith into the practice of medicine and have your practice follow the principles that the Bible lays down. It's great information. I think every healthcare professional should read it. If you'd like to get a copy, call 888-230-2637 or go to our website, cmda.org, and you can order online. Welcome to another issue of TaxWise Moment, and today we have again with us our Vice President of Stewardship, Jamie Campbell. What's the TaxWise topic for today?
Dave, hardly a week goes by that we don't get questions about donor-advised funds. So today I want to talk a little bit more about donor-advised funds as a way to make charitable contributions.
For those who may not be familiar with them, can you explain the basics of what a donor-advised fund is?
Sure. Donor-advised funds have been around since the 1930s, but really in the past several years, they've experienced explosive growth. The majority of charities across the country, including CMDA, are now reporting they receive more money through donor-advised funds than any other planning tool. Basically, donor-advised fund is an account similar to a charitable checking account that you can fund with cash or appreciated securities or even non-cash assets like real estate or closely held business stock. Then you're able to, quote, advise the fund where to send the gifts on your behalf.
Are there any tax benefits to using a donor-advised fund?
Absolutely. The first one is you can help your income tax. You receive an immediate tax deduction the year you contribute to your donor-advised fund, or DAF. And since your DAF is a public charity, contributions immediately qualify for maximum income tax benefits. Then there's capital gains tax. You will incur no capital gains tax on gifts of appreciated assets, like securities and real estate and illiquid assets. For example, if you bought a stock worth $1,000 and it's now worth $10,000 and you give it to your DAF, there are no capital gains taxes on that increase, and you get a tax deduction for the full $10,000.
What else?
Your estate taxes can benefit. Your donor advised fund is not subject to estate taxes. And finally, the great thing about a donor advised fund is you can invest those funds while they're in the donor advised funds, and they will appreciate tax-free.
You know, and it's good, too, to help you manage years when you have increased income and don't want to get pushed into another bracket. It can pull you down a bit.
Yeah, it's a good place to move money to when you maybe have an unexpected bonus or have an increase in the stock market. You can just sweep that money right over into your donor advised fund.
Okay, so now that I have a donor advised fund, how could I use it?
You can use a donor advised fund to support your church, your favorite Christian ministries, private schools, even things like museums or your alma mater. Practically any 501c3 organization can receive funds from a donor advised fund. Each fund has its own policies, so you'll want to check that. But one of the beauties of it is you can even set up automatic monthly gifts from your donor advised fund. For people who use a donor advised fund regularly, it really becomes an extension of their overall financial plan.
What about if I pass away? What happens to the money, or both my wife and I pass away?
You have a donor advised fund.
Yeah.
And you named a beneficiary in there. In many cases, you can pass those along to your children. But even if that's not an option, it's a great opportunity to get your younger children involved and teach them about generosity.
Or you can make your church or CMDA or some other group a beneficiary.
Just like a life insurance policy.
You'd be happy to know I made CMDA my beneficiary.
Well, I was going to talk to you about that just as soon as we finished.
So I'm sold on the idea, obviously, since I've got one of these. If somebody doesn't, how do they get started?
Well, Dave, a quick search of the web will turn up any number of companies that offer donor advised funds, all the big ones, the Fidelities, the Schwabs, the Vanguards, Bank of America, Wells Fargo's. Many of our members have intentionally decided to use organizations like the National Christian Foundation because they know they are working with people who share their same faith and values. There are other good Christian donor advised fund providers out there as well. If you want to contact us here in the stewardship office at CMDA, we're happy to talk through the advantages of using a donor advised fund for your giving.
And what's the best way to do that?
People can contact us toll-free at 888-230-2637 or by email at stewardship@cmda.org.
Jamie, thank you for some great information.
Thanks, Dave.
Let me introduce you to a good friend, Dr. Tim Elmore. He's a best-selling author, a world-renowned expert on Generation Y and Generation Z. He's the CEO of an organization that he started called Growing Leaders. It's a global nonprofit created to develop emerging leaders. He and his team equip schools to empower students with real-life leadership skills. He's got wide media experience, been in Wall Street Journal and Forbes and USA Today and the Washington Post. He's been on many news channels, CNN, Fox, and Friends, you name it. And he's going to teach us how to communicate better with these generations. It may be our own children. It may be those in healthcare that we're dealing with. He's got some interesting insights that are going to be very practical and helpful to you. Tim, it's great to have you on Christian Doctors Digest, and I want to talk about your book, Marching Off the Map. As before we got on recording, I said, you know, I spent a good Saturday reading this. It's an excellent book. What do you mean by marching off the map? I think the title, first thing, is intriguing.
Yeah, it is. Well, I actually borrowed the title from a man who lived centuries ago. In the book, I talk about Alexander the Great, and we all know him as this incredible Greek conqueror. Who marched across the known world, conquering every bit of territory along the way. What some may not know is he was really famous for marching into the unknown world. He marched his troops into lands for which they had no maps. And in fact, he was known to frustrate some of his soldiers when he transformed them into map makers. They were literally mapping as they marched. And I think everybody listening can see where I'm going with this. I think we're in a day where it is not hyperbole to say we are making up new maps as we march into brand new territory in culture, in healthcare, in parenting, in technology, with social media. I just feel like we've got to be willing to draw some new maps for this new territory.
You know, the reason you get into this is because how do we influence students, children, others, as we try to have an impact on their lives, and really the old methods don't work very well. Explain what you mean by that.
When I talk to university professors, I'll often smile and firmly plant my tongue in my cheek when I say, students are no longer looking for a sage on the stage with a lecture. I do think they're looking for a guide on the side with an experience. Hmm. So we encourage anybody, teachers, employers, doctors and nurses, obviously, to be EPIC in our communication with the young, the next generation. And EPIC is an acronym, David. You know I'm the king of acronyms. So the letter E reminds us we need to be experiential. We need to create environments and experiences and then dialogue. We need to be participatory. That's the letter P. That means we need to let them have a say and participate in the outcomes of where this program is going. The letter I is image rich. I think we need to leverage metaphors and images. Visuals are the natural native tongue of this emerging generation. In fact, they're messaging more with icons and images than they are with words. And then lastly, the letter C in EPIC, they're connected. They're connected to each other socially as well as technologically. So what I mean by that is we need to take perhaps that larger group of 25, let's say, and create communities of three. And give them well-crafted questions that can't be answered with yes or no, and allow them to connect with each other. I just believe students support what they help create. But all that to say, that may be always true for all generations, but I actually think this emerging generation, Generation Z, with attention spans of about 8 seconds before they get diverted, we've got to be engaging and we've got to do it in a new way.
What are some of the other characteristics of Generation Z? And explain the ages of, you know, there's the X, Y, Z. What ages are we talking about?
So we've been talking about millennials for 15 years now. Yeah. Millennials are now young professionals or young adults for sure. Gen Z, following Gen Y or the millennials, are really the kids that have grown up in the 21st century. Some would date them having started their life slightly before that. I have them starting at about the turn of the century. They've grown up with terrorism as a normal part of the conversation. Someone's getting blown up somewhere in the world every day, it feels like. Two economic downturns. So 2001 and then 2008, 2009. So some of them are just now seeing a good economy for the first time. Racial unrest, for some, it feels like we're back in the 60s, and I've said that many, many times, but it's just a very, very polarizing, divided time we're in. So Gen Z would have grown up in a little bit darker time than the millennials did, and maybe that's a great way just to spin it. So a couple of thoughts that maybe you can chew on and volley back. Confidence is morphing into caution for kids. The millennials were very confident, maybe even overconfident. You know, they were going to be VP by 28 years old, you know, that sort of thing. whereas Gen Z is a much more cautious generation, and they're overwhelmed by all the 10,000 messages every day they're consuming through social media. Idealism is morphing into pragmatism, which isn't bad, but I think we all would love to have children that are idealistic, just a little idealistic, you know, to believe they can actually change the world. We may need to be hope givers now with this average 15 or 16-year-old. And then lastly, I'll just give you this one too. Anticipation is morphing into anxiety. They have more mental health issues than any generation we've ever measured or evaluated or assessed. It's just a little scary. In fact, the American Psychological Association released a statement not long ago that said the average child in America has the same level of anxiety as a psychiatric patient did in the 1950s.
Wow.
So that's just, to me, we've got to find a way to beat that. I don't think life was supposed to be lived that way. And yet I think the culture snuck up on us and we just weren't ready.
Yeah. How do you connect? You've touched on some of the points. Let's dig into that and the epic thing a little bit more, and other things you've said in the book about how do you connect with your own children that are, you know, been born since 2000, as well as patients and others as you try to influence their lives?
That's a great, great question. I think the first step we need to take as we think about communicating to a younger person is we need to think about incentive. We need to give them a why before the what. Hmm. Now, I'm certainly not the first one to say that, but I want you to, listeners, think about this. First of all, your message that you're trying to communicate to your child or a young patient is up against 10,000 other messages. So good luck with getting yours through, you know. And you're competing against YouTube and Netflix and, you know, just so many other platforms. So I think to give them a why means we take the first couple of minutes and share why what you're about to say is so relevant to their future, even if it's the immediate future, to gain an ear. One of our habitudes, David, you remember habitudes,
sure,
images that form leadership habits and attitudes. One of our habitudes is called house on fire. I believe to be effective in our communication, we need to light a house on fire before we talk about water. That way they've got an incentive to listen. So I think we need to be thinking through what incentive do I give and what why can I offer when I communicate. I think another truth is Facebook or TV. Now, listeners, think for just a second. Facebook and other social media platforms have overtaken hours spent as opposed to TV. In other words, we now spend more time on social media than we do television programs. If you think about it, the reason for that is probably many things, but one of them is TV is just a one-way download. Mm-hmm. Facebook and Instagram is a two-way, it's a volley. It's an interactive thing. So my question for you is your communication more like Facebook or TV? Are you doing a program, if you will, for your listeners? Are you posing questions and making it interactive? I think as fundamental as that sounds, it's essential today to do that. And then one last thought, and I'll let you volley back, David. One of the images that I love the most is called Windows and Mirrors. Windows and Mirrors. Let me tell you a story. This may really be helpful and illustrative of what I'm trying to say. Back in 2005, Steve Jobs was asked to do the commencement speech at Stanford University, and the place was packed out because this incredible, iconic man was going to, you know, deliver some words. And I don't know exactly what they thought they'd hear, but I can imagine. Maybe he was going to, you know, unveil some new Apple product there at Stanford or make a prediction about the future of technology. I think he surprised everyone because he stood up at that podium for less than 15 minutes. And during that period of time, Steve Jobs just shared three personal stories, actually three personal struggles and the lessons he had learned from them. He talked about how he had never graduated from college himself, and there he was at Stanford University. He talked about how he had gotten fired from the company he had started. That's kind of rare. And then he talked about how he had cancer and was going to die probably soon. When he walked off the platform, he got a standing ovation from everybody there. And I think I know why. He practiced windows and mirrors. Here's the principle. When we communicate to an emerging generation, if we will give them a window to our own soul, we actually provide a mirror for them to see their own. I'll say it again. If you'll pull back the curtain and let people see your own personal struggles, your humanity, you'll be vulnerable with them. In fact, we don't do this because we think, well, they'll lose respect for us. I beg to differ. I think we actually gain respect. When we get real, they get responsive. So I guess the last thing I would say, it's maybe intuitive for everybody listening, but we've got to get honest and real. And I realize you're medical professionals, but if we can just pull back the curtain and let them see we're human too, we gain the ear and we gain the attention, if you will, of a teenager or a 20-something that is so desperately hard to gain.
Yeah, and you gain the credibility too. And you can't get them to open up if you don't open up. I think that's very true. And it's a way Jesus taught, wasn't it? I mean, he told a story and shared a principle, told a story.
That's so true. Yeah, we're just imitating the master. That's all we're doing. But these simple pictures are so easy to remember. So I'm hoping that people can remember house on fire, be Facebook, not TV, and give them a window to your soul. That's just easy stuff, I think.
Yeah, and picturing, you know, talking about using images, you've been so effective in doing that, open discussions and make points. And there's an image there or a metaphor or an analogy, people grasp onto it and they don't forget it. You know, as you look at these kids, how do we give them passion? How do we take it to the next step from receiving the information and perhaps accepting it to turning them into the leaders that we want them to be? And I'm thinking of, you know, our docs dealing with students and residents and kids saying, I want to come and shadow at your office because I want to go into medicine. How do we impact them?
That's a great question. And that's probably a question that deserves a better answer than I've got, David, or maybe a longer amount of time. But let me volley a couple of thoughts that might be helpful for our listeners to chew on. One of them is, I think we've got to get better at practicing metacognition, or shall I say, helping them, the listener, the young listener, practice metacognition. This is a term that's taking the education world by storm. Harvard University actually made it popular. They didn't invent it, but they made it popular years ago with Dr. Eric Mazur, a physics professor. But metacognition is really thinking about my thinking. It's basically helping the young person. I'm going to use the word student if you don't mind, everybody doesn't mind. It's helping the student actually own the answer that they're digging for rather than you giving them the answer. So that's not to say we don't have very helpful information to share. We do. But I'll tell you where I learned this. I'll just tell you a story. So I was mentoring a group of university students at San Diego State University years ago when I lived in San Diego. It was a leadership group of college students. And one of the students emailed me and said, Dr. Tim, who's going to choose the topic for our next meeting? And I grabbed my laptop and I just typed in, I can do that. Well, that's what I meant to type. That's what I thought I typed. My letter I is right next to my letter U on my keypad, probably much like yours. And I accidentally typed, you can do that. Well, when I showed up the next week, I opened my mouth to draw a breath and start speaking, and they jumped in. I mean, one of them had an opening game, one of them showed a video, another one had a question, another one had something else to do. They basically tossed it around, but those students owned their learning. I never told them it was an accident, but it was. I'm ashamed to say. I wanted to be this guru, you know, that had this incredible idea, you know. And I think what we've got to do is position them, even though it's messier, to really own what they're doing. So maybe it's turning them loose to dig a little bit, even though they don't want to. They'd rather have you spoon feed the answer, mom or dad or doctor or nurse. But I think it means we're letting them own what it is. So that means you're not a creator, you're a consultant or a commander, I should say. You're a consultant. It means they're the creators in the classroom, not the consumer. And it puts them in an active stage. The teachers that I know that are doing this, and certainly the parents that I know that are doing this, are getting fully engaged kids because the kids are owning what they learn. So I'll stop there for now.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And I like to, you know, you gave some examples in your book about, you know, giving them problem solving, creative problems, you know, how would you deal with this? And instead of here's a bunch of information that you need to memorize, and then they go learn because that's the way it is. And I love the other term used in your book that students want to hack their education. In other words, the information is out there. and they can go get it. So give them a problem to solve, and then they're eagerly looking for it and then applying it into that issue.
I'm so glad you said that. It's offering problems to solve that are real problems that they care about. Mm-hmm. I actually think young people want to do something that's very important and almost impossible. And I think that's how we get their hearts. Another phrase I think I may have used in the book, but it just dawned on me when you were talking, Dave. I actually think young people learn just in time, not just in case. Mm. And very often, anybody that's listening that's a teacher, we teach so many things just in case you need this, you know, in a couple of years. And I actually think we learn in real time. So I have a dear friend that leads short-term mission trips, and he used to do all the training up front before they took the 10-day trip. Like even how to do laundry in this, you know, limited access country. And he decided it didn't work. He actually does it now several days into the trip. And you know why? Because that's when they need to do laundry. That's when they're really incentivized to learn it. So, I mean, it's a simple concept, but any parent out there would say, yep, that's true. My kids learn just in time, not just in case.
Tim, tell us what our kids are facing. What's happening in the culture that is impacting them that we should be aware of?
I think we sometimes don't fully recognize how 21st century culture has impacted a young person who's growing up, only knowing smart technology, et cetera. So I want the listeners to envision two columns in their head. On the left-hand column, I'm going to give you five words that spell the word seen. S-C-E-N-E. I call this our scene today. But then on the right-hand side, very rapidly, I'm going to give you the unintended consequences of that scenario, what we didn't see coming along the way. So real quick, the letter S in scene reminds us our world is full of speed. We want everything faster and faster. We want high-speed internet access and nothing less. We're pacing in front of the microwave. But if I grow up in that world, I can easily assume that slow is bad.
Hmm.
Well, David, you and I both know some things just happen slowly. The letter C in scene. We live in a world of convenience, and we all love the modern day conveniences we enjoy, I think. But if I grow up in a world of convenience, I can easily assume that hard is bad. By the way, the number one phrase that K-12 educators say they hear from students today, they say, this is too hard. They tell their teacher, this is too hard. And I'm thinking, we've done this math equation for decades, Johnny. You can do it too. But everything's been a quick click.
Yeah.
The letter E in scene. We live in a world of entertainment. Now it's in our hands everywhere we go. We want stimuli all the time. If I grow up in a world of entertainment, I can easily assume that boring is bad. Now, I will admit I didn't like boring when I was 16. But let me tell you what we know now that we didn't know when I was 16. Neuroscientists tell us today our brains actually need boredom. They say it's in times when our calendar gives us some margin in the day, we have some space, that we actually develop creativity and empathy, two huge kingdom traits.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, think about the opposite. If I'm living in a world of noise and clutter and I've got my earbuds in all the time, I'm not thinking about anybody else. I'm trying to survive the week. I think we have far too many kids that are trying to survive the week. The letter N in scene reminds us ours is a world of nurture. We are safety obsessed and nurturing our kids. And that can be really good. In fact, all these can be really good. But think about the unwitting message we send if we're nurturing, safety first, safety first. They can get the message, risk is bad. And again, this is the most risk-averse generation of kids we've ever measured. Well, it's because mama's been hovering, keeping them from even playing outside sometimes. And then lastly, the last letter E, I know it's not everywhere, but I see it almost everywhere I go. Ours is a world of entitlement. We feel like we deserve this just because we're here. And think about it. If I grew up in a world of entitlement, I can easily assume that labor is bad. I shouldn't have to work for this. This should be part of what I get. Now, one last thought. As I think about those right-hand column items, slow, hard, boring, risk, and labor, it dawned on me, aren't those the very elements that grow me into a good adult, into a good husband, a good father, a good leader, a good grown-up? And all I'm simply saying is our marvelous world of 21st century technology, which we all love, is accidentally stripping away the very elements that would naturally build life skills in our kids. So all I'm saying is we've got to be more intentional than we did even 10 or 15 years ago. And that's my exhortation to listeners. Let's be intentional to build slow is good, hard is good, boring is okay, because we're countercultural to the world that we live in.
Wow, superb insights. Any other thoughts you have? This is so great, and I really want to recommend Marching Off the Map. Great book, and you've written a lot of great ones, and Habitudes are wonderful for a tool to provoke these discussions and get kids thinking, including your own, and you guys have just produced an enormous number of resources that can be helpful to our members and growing leaders of your ministry.
I appreciate so much getting to chat with you, David. I have such respect for you as a person, but also for CMDA. I think my closing thought would be this. As I think through the communication I have with Generation Z, the emerging generation, it's so easy to default to frustration, at least on my part, because I don't get them. It's like a cross-cultural relationship. You know, I'm actually talking to someone from a different planet or whatever. And I say that tongue-in-cheek, but it's easy to get frustrated. And so I want to offer one last image just to encourage people. It's how to communicate and specifically how to offer feedback to someone who's young. And I call it, you'll like this, surgeons and vampires. So here it is. Think about it. Both surgeons and vampires draw blood. Both of them create angst to the people that they're approaching. You know, I mean, let's face it, you know, surgery's never fun for the receiver, but, right, you know, that sort of thing. But the outcome is very, very, very different. Think about a vampire for a minute. All those old black and white movies we watched of vampires, or even the newer television shows, the vampire sneaks up on somebody, bites them, draws all the blood. The person never recovers. The surgeon goes in, well-lit room, lots of planning. Everybody knows what's about to happen. And he or she surgically removes that tumor, doesn't slice up the whole body, just takes away what needs to be taken away. All I'm saying is when we offer feedback, I often default to a vampire. I'm just mad. I'm angry. I'm frustrated. I want to, quote, get it off my chest, end quote. I think we need to be surgeons emotionally just like we are physically and vocationally. Let's make sure we sit down and be life-giving and operate out of belief, not relief. That's the word I want you to remember. Let's give feedback out of belief. I may have to say something hard, but it's because I believe in that person I'm looking at, that's 16 or 22 or 25 or 28. And because I believe them, I'm going to call out something better rather than I just got to vent because I'm so ticked off. That rarely gets to the goal that we want to get to. So let's be surgeons, not vampires, emotionally, not just vocationally.
Boy, and that is so important with our kids because those are the ones we tend to overreact with. And they need to know we believe in them and to believe what God can do with them and communicate that again and again and again, no matter what the situation.
No doubt about it. Yeah.
Tim, it has been great to have you on Christian Doctors Digest. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule. And we just look forward to having you back on again sometime.
Sounds great, David. I'm honored. Thank you.
Wow, wasn't that great? And I encourage you to get your own copy. I mean, I read this book cover to cover. It's available here at CMDA through our Life and Health Resources. Just give us a call at 888-230-2637, and one of my wonderful staff will help you. Or if you prefer, go to cmda.org and look for our resource area, and you'll find it there, and we'll get it in the mail to you very quickly. It'll be something that'll be useful to you every day. Hey, there's only one thing I want to talk about as far as stuff coming up, and that is one of the most important meetings we've had since I've been here for 25 years, since 2004, and that is our national convention this year. Now, the dates, mark them down, May 2nd through the 5th. We're going to be looking back over the last 25 years and looking forward to what God has ahead as I step down and Dr. Mike Chupp comes on as the new CEO. September the 1st, it's not going to be very long. This is going to be a meeting that's probably one of the largest ones we've ever had because past presidents, past trustees, People have been involved in CMDA are going to be there. You're going to see friends you haven't seen in a long time. And we've got a stellar lineup of speakers. John Stone Street is going to be there, who's regularly on Breakpoint. Many of you listen to that. Nancy Piercy, written numerous books on apologetics. Stan Key is going to be our Bible teacher. He's always a perennial favorite. I'll be speaking. Mike Chupp, well, you'll get to meet him. It's just going to be a great time. So I encourage you, before we run out of space, to join us. It's 888-230-2637 as our number, or you can just get online at cmda.org and register there. You're going to make new friends and have a ball and be stronger for it. Bring the family. We have children's programs, spousal programs. It's just going to be a delightful time in the mountains in the spring as everything begins to bloom. I hope to see you there. Recently, I was talking to a group of doctors and students, and I encouraged them to be members of CMDA. And, you know, membership is getting more passe. I'd be the first one to say that. But it's still so important because the CMDA works in public policy, for example. The currency that gets us the open door and people to pay attention to what we're saying on bioethical issues that you and I both care about is the fact that we represent a group of doctors that agree on these principles that we're trying to share with policymakers. And that's so important. The practicality of that makes it helpful in what we're doing. But more importantly is when we have a member of CMDA, we have an ongoing relationship with them. You're getting this Christian Doctor's Digest because you're a member. And we've given you practical help on this one, on direct primary care, on how to communicate with Generation Y and Generation Z. And that's what today's Christian Doctor and our placement service, and you just name resource after resource, our malpractice counselors and other things that we do, ethical hotline, are there to help equip you to more effectively serve the Lord and effectively serve those you serve. And so I want to encourage you as we close this Christian Doctor's Digest to not only continue to be a member, maybe even a lifetime member, but also to encourage your friends to do the same. Many of you know Christian healthcare professionals that are not part of CMDA, and encourage them to join and say, hey, this has impacted my life. There's nothing more powerful than one healthcare professional turning to another saying, I've been part of this organization, here's why, and this will be beneficial to you as well. And we say that not for monetary reasons. We say that because our ministry is to impact healthcare professionals, and you can help us expand that impact. And oftentimes, you have to mention it a half a dozen times or get them involved by saying, hey, let's go to a national meeting together. Let's go on a mission trip together, or we're doing something here locally, and why don't you come? And as they begin to see how this is going to meet a need in their life, then they will want to get more involved. So we've got materials. If you'd like to have them to tell people more about CMDA, just give us a call at 888-230-2637 or send us an email, and we'll be happy to get that into your hands. You can point them to cmda.org where they can join online very easily. And there's significant discounts for first-time members. So I'm excited about what God's doing through this organization, what He has done. We're now up to over 19,000 members. Man, I'd like to see it at 30,000, wouldn't you? And the impact that can have in healthcare and also with what's going on in our world. So there's your assignment. I hope you'll take it and look for those opportunities to insert that in the conversation as people talk about the issues they're dealing with and the problems they're having and say, hey, I know a great organization that can help you. If you haven't been part of it, now's the time. Well, till we get a chance to get together again, we continue to pray for you. We continue to serve you and look forward to that time we get together again on another issue of Christian Doctor's Digest. God bless.
Christian Doctor's Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctor's Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctor's Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.